Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at PurdueGlobal.edu.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man and being a country megastar while also having 7 kids. You know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Relax this Sunday with a little moment to yourself and the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am that host of yours who cannot sing worth shit and yet does this every time. I am Liv. And so today I'm here with something a little different, kind of. So a couple of weeks back, God, when was it? I honestly don't even remember. Time is a flat circle. I did that episode where I re-listened to the very first episode of this podcast and I kind of expanded upon those things that I introduced to you guys at the beginning. I corrected some pieces. I added additional context, all of these different things. And I thought it was really interesting. And thankfully, Spotify now has this ability where I can ask you guys what you think directly after you listen to the episode. And so many of you agreed that I should do more of these, which was such a joy. Thank you. I think like 8 people picked the not really interested in more option, and then it was like 90% heck yes. And I fucking love that. I don't know why I just said heck, but I fucking loved that. And so I really, today's episode is based in that idea, but it is also based in what I am working on right now. So not only have I been spending my days, you know, coming up with content for Women's History Month, but I am also in the midst of preparing next month's special series of episodes, which is a very deep dive historical look into Greece during the Bronze Age and the collapse of the Bronze Age. We are diving really, really heavily into that history. And by we, I mean Michaela is doing such incredible research on it. And then I am trying to figure out what I'm talking about based on Michaela's incredible research. And we are planning and recording conversations with some absolutely fascinating people. What that means is that it's a lot of work. But then I also did agree to, I think I mentioned it in a recent episode, I am writing this big introductory, contextual, historical, cultural look at Medusa as a character for a book of short stories that is coming out sometime with Flame Tree Press. You can Google that if you're interested. But what that means is that I've been also diving very deep into Medusa, and I am sort of caught up right now in this web of trying to understand all the ways that people see her now, all the ways that her story has been manipulated. And I mean that both maliciously and not, but just a pure manipulation of her story. Because honestly, I know I'm a broken record with this, but Medusa of all characters, her story has been more manipulated, literally melded and changed and adjusted over the millennia more than, I swear, anyone else. And it's absolutely fascinating. Like, right now I am just trying to get a grasp on all the ways in which her story has been changed, the ways in which people go and say, like, oh, but the real story is X, or the truth is X, the original myth, blah, blah, blah. All of these things. And, you know, sometimes they are wild departures from what actually exists in the ancient sources, told to be, quote unquote, the original myth. Or sometimes they are just people who have taken Ovid's version of the story, which is a very distinct and unique version of the story from the ancient world, and they have claimed this to be a kind of original or accurate or any number of things. And I'm just so utterly fascinated in people's desire to do this, both in terms of the ways in which her story has been sort of broken and adjusted and manipulated by misogyny, but also in the ways that her story, the same thing has been done in her story by people who are explicitly reclaiming something in Medusa or finding strength in her as a survivor, all of these different things. And so I'm looking at all of these things and trying to just get a grasp even on, like, what people understand about her today, you know, and let alone all of the diving and research I'm going to be doing into, you know, what her story looked like in the ancient world. But honestly, I'm just so caught up in all of these versions and understanding and beliefs around Medusa that I just thought, you know, it is International Women's History Month. I think I've added an extra word in there. It is Women's History Month. It was recently International Women's Day. And so why the fuck not revisit one of my earliest episodes on Medusa, because not only has it become a true and really, really lasting favorite of all of yours, which I absolutely love, but it also, you know, is this really interesting look at Medusa's story. And because I covered her story as it stands in Ovid, I am now so curious about how I went about telling her story all the way back in 2018, because frankly, for me, it's been 6 years and I don't know what the fuck I said. And so I'm going to re-listen to the Medusa section of that episode, because in that episode, I did cover Arachne's story as well. And we're going to look at what I would like to add contextually now, as well as how this fits with the wider Medusa that I have been seeing in my research. So basically, all to say, today is just a broad, unscripted Medusa rant of an episode, both examining that earliest episode I did back in 2018, and also her, just fucking Medusa. This is a thought experiment on Medusa. This is episode 252. What makes a monster? What if Ovid's Medusa was thinly veiled misogyny? In in looking at Medusa's story and how it has been interpreted in the past, I mean, honestly, even in the past 10 to 20 years, I think that's what I'm most interested in right now. It is so inextricably tied to Ovid's version of the story now that it is very difficult to tease out what is actually going on. And having just listened to my own telling of this story, I absolutely emphasize that it was Ovid, but I think even we're going to get into what I think about what is going on. But basically, I am going to play the entirety of my original retelling of Medusa's story as it appears in Ovid. It's only like 8 minutes long. And then I'm going to talk about what is going on with Ovid's interpretation and how we see it today, in addition to what I did and how I think I would do it differently now, and what exactly I want to emphasize about her story, because, oh, there is so much going on here. Now, trigger warning, Ovid's version of the story does explicitly include sexual assault by Medusa. It's not particularly graphic in the way that I've told it, but it's absolutely there, so take warning.
Phorcus was a primordial sea god, Keto, a famous and terrible sea monster. When they got together to procreate, this results in the birth of 3 Gorgons, sisters, 2 immortal, Stheno and Urali, and 1 named Medusa, who is mortal. While the story of Medusa and her sisters exists throughout Greek mythology, from some of the oldest sources, including the patriarchal monster himself, Hesiod, this story, this particular origin story, comes from my main man Ovid, just like Arachne. You know what that means, Roman names for the gods. Medusa is stunning, a beautiful, unforgettable woman. Sure, she's the daughter of a primordial sea god and a straight-up sea monster, but she is beautiful. There are so many men after her, so many vying for her attention. Of course, though, with attention from men and astonishing beauty comes hatred from the goddesses. Because, for the 100th time, these myths were thought up by men who all assumed that if a woman encountered another woman whom she might consider more beautiful, she would immediately hate that woman and wish all the tragedy in the world upon her. It's in our DNA, you know. Medusa's beauty is known all around, but there's one quality about her that is considered her most impressive asset. The best and most stunning thing about her is her hair. Medusa has magnificent flowing hair. And this is not the serpent locks you know of. This is legit, beautiful, jealousy-inducing hair. Medusa is so beautiful and her hair so incredible to behold that she catches the eye of one Neptune. Poseidon. Neptune spots Medusa one day, and he knows he just has to have her. And we all know what that means. It means that because she is wearing a short peplos, or because her hair is styled in whatever way was particularly sexy for ancient Greek women, for whatever reason, she obviously deserves what is about to happen to her. It all stems from somewhere, friends. Neptune spots Medusa one day, and he begins devising a way to get what he wants. So, one afternoon, when she's worshipping in Minerva's temple, minding her own fucking business, just trying to support the goddess of wisdom, Neptune comes upon her. And he rapes her. Neptune rapes Medusa within the walls of Minerva's temple. Rapes her. Minerva, in all her glory, determines that this is a slight against her personally. She is a virgin goddess. This isn't something she's experienced herself, and it isn't something she wants to see. A woman has been raped in her temple. Raped. It's offensive, horrendous, an atrocity. Minerva hides her eyes while it's happening. She doesn't want to witness this. She is chaste. She is pure. Somebody has to be punished for this. Minerva determines that it is Medusa who must be punished for being raped by a god. As a punishment for being raped, you know, because that's definitely not punishment enough, let alone punishment for doing absolutely nothing wrong. As punishment for being raped, Minerva turns Medusa's beautiful, flowing hair into snakes. Awful, terrifying, hissing snakes. So she hides. She hides because, fine, she also turns humans to stone with a single look, but it's also because a goddess turns her hair into snakes, making her less than fun at dinner parties. Medusa hides. She hides until one day a random man shows up with a sword, a shield, a bag, and winged sandals. On that day, the man uses the shield as a mirror so he doesn't see Medusa's face. She doesn't want him to see her hair as it is, made of angry, hissing snakes. She avoids him, but he's there to get her. He uses the shield so that she can't use her one form of defense, turning people into stone with a single look. This strange man who's appeared out of nowhere uses the shield as a mirror until finally he gets to her. With one swift motion, this strange man slices off Medusa's head. The snakes hiss and cry, and her head falls to the ground. This stranger who appeared from nowhere still avoids looking at her. Everyone has avoided looking at her ever since her hair was turned to snakes in punishment for being raped. This has been her life. Her life ends with a slicing sound through the air, a thud on the ground as her head falls, and the snakes stop their hissing and lie still. And all that remains are children she never knew she had. From her headless body spring a man and a horse. Chrysaor, the man, springs fully formed from the poor woman's neck. And the horse, with massive feathery wings, shoots out, flying up into the sky, testing his wings for the first time. Neither child, man or flying horse, ever gets to meet their mother. All because Athena is a fucking bitch who blamed women for being raped by awful men. It all comes from somewhere, people.
Wow. Okay. There is so much happening here. Honestly, I remain very proud of this episode. I want to be very clear about that. It is quite accurate to the story as it appears in Ovid. It is obvious that I got the point across, the horrors of Medusa's story as it appears in Ovid, and I think that it was told well. But now, oh, there's just so much more to say. First and foremost, I think it's important to contextualize Medusa's story in Ovid, like in Ovid itself, because unlike so many other stories of transformation within the broader Metamorphoses, like Arachne, say, who also appears in the rest of that regular episode, the story of Medusa does not appear until after Medusa is dead. We meet Perseus in Ovid's Metamorphoses after he has already killed Medusa, taken her head, and then used it to kill other people. So we are visiting her story in the context of violence. Not just violence against Medusa, but violence with the use of Medusa as the weapon. And I think that that is both fascinating, but also really important when we're looking at what exactly Ovid says about her. So I want to just read a section from Ovid's Metamorphoses in this new translation by Stephanie McCarter, which of course I didn't have when I first did this episode because it didn't exist. And basically, so we meet Perseus having killed Medusa, carrying her head in a bag. He has used it against a handful of others and has just saved Andromeda. And they are, you know, celebrating in Ethiopia with Andromeda's family. She's just been saved by a sea monster. Obviously, there is so much going on there. You can listen back to my very detailed two-part episode, I believe, on Perseus for more. But that is the context for this, okay? We are celebrating the use of Medusa's head as a deadly weapon. And during those celebrations, basically, someone is like, hey, how'd you get that head? And so, you know, Perseus tells the story as we know it. He talks about the gray eye, how they shared an eye and a tooth, and how he used this against them to give up the location of Medusa. And then, you know, he gets to Medusa. And this is where I'm going to quote it. The barren and tree-spiked crags where gorgons have their home. Throughout the field and paths he could see statues of humans and wild beasts that had been changed to stone when they returned Medusa's gaze. Yet he had seen his looks reflected in his bronze shield, and as she slept, he snatched her head clean off. He snatched her head clean off. The lack of violence in this act, compared to the use of Medusa's head as a weapon of violence, is so striking to me. Now, of course, I won't pretend to know the Latin well enough. The translation that I would have used when I first told this story says that he cut that gorgon's head off from her neck. Something about snatched, though, being used by McCarter here feels incredibly intentional, and so I kind of want to trust her telling of it. She wouldn't have said snatched unless there was a lack of violence in this act. And so that is our introduction to the fact that Medusa was once a living being. Because we have already had like two full sections talking about the capabilities of her head. But this is where we know that she was a living thing, and that not only was there such little violence in her death, but we also learn that she was sleeping when this man just snuck in, you know, used this shield so that he could look at her without dying and just basically removed her head. The emphasis here is that her head is a thing to be used. It is not a thing that deserves to be on the body of the living creature that it belongs to, and that is so important. But then, of course, we get to the real meat of her story, right? That detailed description that you just re-listened to, that you know, that I recorded all the way back in 2018, and I was able to turn into this very dramatic act, a real narrative story. I'm quite impressed with, actually, what happened there. I think that I had almost gaslit myself into believing that exists within Ovid, that he is providing us with this sympathetic and detailed story of her fate and how she came to be, you know, who she was, how she came to be this snake-haired quote-unquote monster who turns people to stone. I was also convinced that there is a detailed story, and I certainly gave one to you back then, which is why I want to very explicitly read to you the entirety, okay? The entirety of Ovid's telling of how Medusa came to have the fate that she had.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay, so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
So after Perseus has explained how he got Medusa's head at this feast, someone asks him basically, like, you noted that, you know, her two sisters were immortal and she was mortal. And we get the implication here that only Medusa had the snaky hair. And that, of course, you know, as we know well, only Medusa could turn people to stone. And so someone asks him, like, hey, why was that? And this is what Perseus says. Quote, since you seek things worth the telling, here is the reason. Once acclaimed for beauty, she was the fervent hope of many suitors, and her most striking feature was her hair. I found a young man who alleged he'd seen it. They say the sea god raped her in Minerva's temple. Jove's daughter turned away, chaste eyes veiled by her aegis. This was not unpunished. She changed the Gorgon's hair into foul serpents, and even now, to stun her foes with fright, she wears upon her chest those snakes she made. That's all of it. That's the whole story. It's conveyed to us not only as this kind of afterthought, because that is the end of Perseus's telling of the story to the people of Ethiopia. It's not only presented as this kind of afterthought at the end, after her head has been used to cause such incredible violence, but it is conveyed almost like a rumor. And I find that to be incredibly interesting. He basically says it's a rumor, right? He says, they say the sea god raped her in Minerva's temple. And obviously that could be just a method of Ovid's storytelling, but to me it feels incredibly relevant given that Ovid is the first person to introduce not only the idea of an explicit sexual assault — you all know I would argue that that sexual assault does also occur in Hesiod's earliest version of her story — but he is definitely, certainly, the first to introduce the idea that it happened in Athena's temple, and that it is linked to Athena in this way, that Athena transformed her to have this hair. That is, as far as we know it, a completely Ovidian invention. And it's important to recognize that, just because it does really change the story of Medusa and how we see her. Now, the thing about all of this is that it really, you know, it is presented in this way of, it's just kind of an afterthought. It's a rumor. It's, oh, they say this is what happened. It's very much just sort of a throwaway line in the grand scheme of, Perseus has brought this woman's head in to do great damage. And yet, it has become this thing today where, you know, you Google the story of Medusa and this is what you will get. I want to look at how Medusa is viewed today. So I'm going to just share a little bit of what comes up when you just Google Medusa. Okay, so first, one of the top video result that Google gives is a History Channel clip talking about her story, and oh, is it really something? One, it presents Ovid's story as explicitly the Greek myth, which is, of course, completely not only untrue, but just lacks so much important context about what exactly is going on with the ancient sources. I can't even get into it, but it really dramatizes all of it. I do believe that it is one of the places, and there are many, I want to get into this too, there are many places that claim she was a priestess of Athena. Now, that's something even I have heard so often that when I just revisited this Ovidian telling, I was expecting to find it. But you will note that there was nowhere in what I've just read to you where it says she was a priestess. I mean, I suppose the implication could be there because she was in Athena's temple, but like, that really doesn't suggest anything about being a priestess. Like, anyone would go into those temples. It was a completely ubiquitous act of entering a temple for a goddess like Athena, especially a goddess like Athena, like one of the most widely worshipped goddesses in the ancient Greek world. Like, everyone is just walking into her temple. It does not require like a priestess status. So I find that really interesting. But this video is just honestly cuckoo bananas if you want to check it out. But as you go further into Medusa on Google, what I'm fascinated by is the sort of the questions that you can, you know, prompt, right? So there's a list of questions here on Google. The first says, why was Medusa turned evil? Which is fascinating. And I'm not going to click on this link. I want to just read to you what appears on Google. I'm assuming that there is important context added at the link, because the first result for why was Medusa turned evil is from the Met Museum in New York. So I hope that this is not what they say, but the actual sentence, the paragraph rather, that shows up on Google is, the snake-haired Medusa does not become widespread until the first century BC. What? The Roman author Ovid describes the mortal Medusa as a beautiful maiden seduced by Poseidon in a temple of Athena. Such a sacrilege attracted the goddess's wrath, and she punished Medusa by turning her hair to snakes. Now, again, I'm assuming that there is extra context on this website, but the problem I want to raise is that there is no context on Google, which, of course, is just like a broad problem for Google in so many ways, but I am fascinated by what it is doing to Medusa so specifically. And then the next question, all right, what does Medusa symbolize? This says, this is from it is from a website called This Jungian Life. I know what we're going to get. And it says, as a Gorgon, Medusa represents a primordial force of chaos and destruction, embodying the untamed and unpredictable aspects of the natural world. Her petrifying gaze can be interpreted as a reminder of the inherent danger and potential for devastation that exists within the natural order. Why? There are so many monsters from Greek myth that I believe that this is actually applicable to. Monsters like the Hydra, the Chimera, Typhon, so specifically. There are a long list of monsters that this applies to that do represent the primordial force and of chaos and destruction of the natural world. There are absolutely monsters that do this. Medusa is simply not one of them. Her story, remember, as it exists in Hesiod, I mean, I have this memorized at this point. The story as it exists in Hesiod is that Medusa was born a Gorgon to Phorcus and Keto with her sisters. She was the only mortal Gorgon. He does not give any explanation for why that might be. He says that Poseidon, quote unquote, lay with her, but the implication there is that it is very unlikely to be consensual and that she suffered a woeful fate. He describes Perseus cutting off her head and her children, Pegasus and Chrysaor, being birthed from the stump of her severed neck. That is her story in the earliest surviving source. There is not a single reference to her causing any damage to the world, to a single person. Just the notion that once her head is cut off, at the very least, it can be used to turn people to stone. Of course, we can gather that that might have been applicable before it was cut off her head, particularly when we get to these more detailed versions where Perseus has to use the shield as a mirror. However, there is not a single reference to her having harmed anyone before we reach Ovid's telling of the story. And so there is just simply not a single lick of evidence to suggest that she does represent this kind of chaos of the natural world. Even when we get to Ovid, it still doesn't stand. She is still given this sympathetic story. We do learn that she is surrounded by statues of those she has transformed to stone. But there is still no implication that she did it intentionally, that she did it with any kind of malice. There is no version that I have ever come across in 7 years of obsessing over her and being well aware of the ancient sources. There is no version of an ancient source on Medusa's story that suggests that when she was alive, she intentionally committed any harm to any living creature. And yet we get this kind of psychologizing, this philosophizing on her as this source of chaos and destruction. I have seen it in countless places, and it just makes me want to scream. Because while that is so applicable to so many monsters, and like, it is interesting if it was applicable, but I want to hear one tiny piece of ancient evidence that suggests that this is applicable to Medusa, because I can't find it. And then we get to, you know, more generic questions about Medusa on Google, about the possibility of her, you know, as a beautiful person but being cursed. There's a Medium article that is clearly talking about Ovid and says that she was originally a golden-haired fair maiden. So we're also whitewashing her, given she's meant to be found in North Africa. Northwest Africa. Yeah. Golden-haired, fair maiden. Get a grip. The idea of a maiden, too, is very uncertain. Obviously, sometimes that word now is meant to just kind of apply to young woman, but etymologically speaking, it means virgin, which there's no suggestion of that again. And, you know, certainly I guess she was unmarried. So if we're going with that, she was, but she was born a Gorgon. Even Ovid, to be clear, even Ovid emphasizes that she was born a Gorgon. He says she was beautiful, but she was born a Gorgon. She was born a Gorgon to these sea gods, Phorcus and Keto. There is nothing to suggest that she was particularly human. The word beauty is used, but it is certainly open to interpretation as to what exactly that means. And then we get to some Quora questions. Oh, gods, are those messy? And you know, I actually just realized I missed the very first question that appears on Google. The people also ask. The top one is, what is the real story of Medusa? And this comes from the World History Encyclopedia. And again, I hope that the website includes context, but if people are just reading this paragraph that pops up, it says Medusa was seduced by Neptune, Poseidon, in a temple to Minerva, Athena, and in revenge, Minerva turned Medusa's beautiful head of hair into snakes, and she was both mortal and had the ability to turn men to stone. Perseus was sent to cut off her head. Now, in this case, I did want to make sure that this website includes more context. And gods, I really hope people click on this, because it does very explicitly say that the best known story comes from Ovid and then describes what I read earlier. But then the following question after this is Medusa evil or good? And it says there are no stories that tell us of Medusa turning people to stone, nor any tales of her harassing or killing people, unlike other Greek monsters such as Scylla and Charybdis. Although she had the power to kill, she was not inherently evil. So thank you, worldhistory.org. But I want to talk about a little about what it means that Ovid's version has become what it has today. It can be empowering, I want to say up front. I don't want to take away from the empowerment that does come with Medusa being a survivor of assault. I think that it is incredibly important to see that structure, you know, being used in the myths. But I would argue that using Ovid's version for that it's not kind to Medusa, and I don't think that it brings across the same point that people want it to make, especially now that I have reread it. The idea that she is introduced through violence of the use of her head as a weapon long, long, long before we ever hear anything about her as a person is incredibly important. And that, you know, her sympathetic origin story is conveyed over like four lines as an afterthought is also incredibly important. I don't think that Ovid's version is kind to Medusa. I'm sure I've said before that it was. I don't think that's true. I don't think that he was being kind in telling her story. I think that it is an insult to Medusa. I believe that Hesiod's version, for all Hesiod was flawed as all shit, I believe that the earliest surviving source for Medusa's story is the most kind to her. It takes all of the blame off of her for what Perseus did in killing her. It does convey the idea that she was a survivor of Poseidon. Hesiod does not explicitly call it assault, but almost nothing in the ancient Greek sources is explicitly called assault, and particularly not in Hesiod, because it wasn't a question of whether the woman was willing. That just wasn't a question they were asking or answering in those sources. That isn't to say it wasn't something that occurred to them or that they didn't care, but in the sources as they stand, it wasn't a question that was being asked or answered. I think we can and should read into Hesiod as being non-consensual, particularly because of the word choices, the word used to suggest that she quote-unquote lay with Poseidon, because that is always how it is translated. As far as I could tell, and I'm not particularly good at ancient Greek, but I do know how to search through the usage of words in ancient Greek, the word used, for all that I have been able to dig into the source, the word used in Hesiod means ultimately something like to pluck out a superfluous hair. And as it has been used to convey sexual intercourse, it appears in Hesiod and in the Iliad when discussing Achilles' relationship with Briseis. As far as I know, it was not used beyond that particularly. And so the idea that a word that is used to describe sex also means to pluck out a superfluous hair and was used when discussing a man having sex with a woman that he took as a war gift, basically. There's a better word for that, but she was abducted from her life and brought to live in a camp for the enemy. The idea that that word being used to describe Poseidon and Medusa doesn't convey some kind of violence is fucking wild to me. Like, it so obviously does. Whereas this story, as it appears in Ovid, while explicit about an assault, is not kind about the assault. It not only demonizes Athena and suggests that she would do something like this, but it is not sympathetic to Medusa. This woman has had her head used for like 500 lines of poetry to describe horrible violence. And then when somebody's finally like, hey, she was alive once, right? They tell this story. And yeah, I mean, looking at it now with all of the context that I know, I really don't think that Ovid's is at all something that we should, you know, be finding some kind of solace in. I don't know. Hesiod's it to me. And again, I don't want to take away from what anyone else has or has not found in Ovid for themselves. But I think what tends to frustrate me when it comes to Medusa is how often Ovid's story is conveyed as the quote-unquote true or original myth. And it's done so often out of this suggestion that because, you know, it gives her this origin story, it is somehow better for her to suggest that she actually was once beautiful and transformed into what she was. And I think that that has a lot of layers of misogyny that the people using it don't want. And I don't think that they are aware of the misogyny that's inherent in that by saying it. But the idea that she was once beautiful and then made ugly is, I mean, it, I want there to be like a word like fat shaming, but for looks, because that's what it feels like to me, right? Whereas Medusa was a Gorgon. And that made her not human, but what it didn't make her was ugly. Like, there's nothing in the Greek forms of Medusa to suggest that she felt ugly as a Gorgon or that people saw Gorgons as ugly. They were simply not human, right? They were divine in some way. They do have this kind of monstrous context, but monstrosity does not mean ugly. And monstrosity is not an opposite to beauty. And I think to suggest that monstrosity is an object to opposite to beauty has a lot of misogynist undertones, right? Like, this monstrous woman can't be beautiful. When how I see Medusa is that she was born that way, and that's just simply who she was. It wasn't an insult to say that she was monstrous. She was born a monster. And again, the connotations of monstrosity as ugly not only has misogynist undertones, but it is also a more modern construct, right? Like, there's nothing to suggest that the ancient Greeks were around going like, oh, Medusa was ugly. She was monstrous. Her monstrosity served a purpose. It was not about ugliness. It was about protection and I mean, it was mostly about protection, right? Like, her symbol was also used as an apotropaic device. Of course, it is a little bit, it's about her head being off her body and being able to be used as a weapon. That's why it appears as a form of protection. Unfortunately, also there are rumors that go around online that suggest that the Gorgon symbol was used. I forget what the details are, but it's something to do with sexual assault and or used by women in the ancient world as a protective device. Like it was somehow a more feminine or a woman specific thing. That isn't true. There's no evidence of that. It was simply a protective device, but that protective device is linked to the fact that after her head was cut off from her body, it was put onto Athena's shield, right? It was explicitly Athena's protective device and therefore was used as such by humans as well, which I think that it doesn't take away from the value. It is just the context of she was a protective device. And I think that that's really important when we are looking at the idea of monstrosity and how monstrosity does not have to be evil. Monstrosity does not have to be, it does not have to come with malice or destruction. I mean, obviously in this case, her head was used for destruction when it was off her body, but Medusa's monstrosity is not inherently tied to violence. And I think that that is in itself a kind of act of resistance, that she was monstrous, but that wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't a bad thing to be monstrous in this context. And I think that when Ovid introduces the idea that she was once beautiful and sought after, and then Athena made her monstrous and ugly, I think that that is mean to Medusa. It is mean to women. It is mean to assault survivors. I think that is considerably more harmful than the version where Medusa was just born that way. Medusa in Hesiod, in her earliest source, is born that way, and it doesn't make her any less of a victim or survivor of assault. It doesn't make her any less of a victim of Perseus's murder of her. It is just who she was, and I think that taking that away, I mean, it just feels to me like it's screaming of the importance of beauty over anything else. And then, of course, we get the reading of it that Athena actually helped Medusa in this quote-unquote curse, that, you know, she prevented her from getting assaulted again. And I think there's so many problems with that reading. Of course, the number one in terms of my concerns are it has absolutely no basis in the ancient sources. And I think a lot of times when it is conveyed by people, it is suggested that it is somehow evidenced in the ancient sources, and I mean, that's just simply untrue, and you know me, I'm just obsessed with sticking to the ancient sources and getting what we can from them, but what actually exists within them. I don't think there's anything wrong with looking beyond them and theorizing and questioning what other people might have believed that never got written down, but to suggest that, you know, that this is what was happening, I think that it is ultimately, I understand that it is well-intentioned, that it is meant to be a kind of taking back of one's trauma, but I think that it ultimately does the opposite of that, right? It suggests that in order to not be assaulted, you need to be ugly, right? Like it feels to me like she was asking for it. I know that's not what it is meant to be, but to me it screams, you know, she was wearing a short skirt. You know, Athena might as well have transformed her to be wearing coveralls so that she wouldn't be assaulted again, right? And so I just think that the use of Ovid's is really unfortunate, how widespread that it has become. Just because ultimately, I really think that we could find the same empowerment that is coming from this version of the story, but without all of the sort of icky underlying misogyny that comes with it. We can find that in the oldest surviving source, Hesiod's, which, I mean, Hesiod broadly, pretty misogynist source, and yet still this version really gives her, it just really emphasizes, I guess, how faultless she was in the situation, and therefore how shitty it makes the gods look, Perseus look, all of it. Like, to me, this is the Medusa that feels the most powerful or the most transgressive, I guess. And I can't totally put into words, like, why the Hesiod one has those qualities, but comparatively to the Ovid, I do think it lacks just a lot of the ick that I've personally found in revisiting this source and in just, like, really digging into the way that people online really, like, dig their heels in to her story. Like, Hesiod's is simple. It's to the point. It just says what happened in a couple of lines. And I think that is almost the most powerful, because she did nothing and everything happened to her. And it doesn't have agency and it doesn't have, like, any kind of overt empowerment. But I don't know. To me, it's still a good reminder that, like, she is not evil or scary or ugly. She is simply a Gorgon, and a Gorgon is a monster, and there's literally nothing violent or dangerous about that inherently. And I think that's what matters most to me. Anyway, it turns out when I don't script something, I can get real good and rambly with these thoughts. Thank you all so much for listening. This was really a little experiment about, like, what exactly I am capable of without researching a script in front of me. I won't be doing it a lot, but I think it's really interesting to kind of just explore these thoughts, particularly when it comes to somebody like Medusa. Like, I just feel like so much lives in my brain when it comes to her, and I've been doing so much really weird research digging in for this piece I'm writing, that, like, I just was so inspired to talk about her and to look at all the ways that her story has been manipulated. Again, both good and bad. And I'm not saying it's all intentional manipulation or that it is all damaging, but it has been manipulated, right? It has been changed and altered. And I feel like today, you know, her earliest sources, like, tend to just be lost in the noise that exists around her. And I mean, it's nice that she's so incredibly famous and popular and also so divisive. But yeah, oh, it's utterly fascinating. Oh, Medusa, like, there's a reason that I could talk about her like this forever, and also write a ton of stuff about her, because Medusa. As always, let's end with a 5-star review from one of you incredible listeners. This one comes from Hannah Mack, 13, from the States. Whimsical and fun. I listen to these at work, which makes the workday a fun experience. I also love to read fantasy books, and knowing more about the origin / backstory of myths adds more dimension to the characters, which I love. Thank you. That was incredibly fun. Please leave me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if you want me to read it on the show, because they fill me with joy, and then I get to read your review. Again, thank you all for listening. Wild times. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, my assistant producer. Laura Smith is the audio engineer and production assistant. Select music in this episode was by Luke Chaos. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcasts Network. Listen on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And find me on Patreon, where there's a ton of back bonus content, as well as just your ability to support the 2 free episodes that I give you every week. If you want to help me keep that up and ensure that I am not reliant on capitalist ads, you know, feel free. Until then, that's what we got. Thank you all so much. You are the absolute best. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee.
visit RiteRug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Rite Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.